here we are in July already, and I thought I would just take a minute and just remind you that we're over halfway through the year. So I don't know how you're doing on your New Year's resolutions, but like, hang in there. Anybody like still going strong? Yes, Jesse. My New Year's resolution is to climb 12A. Does anybody know what that means? So in rock climbing, you have all these grades, and Raya's always encouraging me to set goals that I don't think I can attain, and that's one of them. I just don't know if I'm like capable, but I'm pushing it, and I'm like halfway there, but I'm starting to hit the ceiling. So we'll see how it goes. But my family and I have been, I used to climb forever ago, and then like finally got that bug again to go back like about a year and a half ago, and I love it. I love rock climbing. And one of the reasons that I like it so much is you're pushing yourself right up to the brink of your capacity every single time, right? You're getting to that point where you're like just barely not strong enough, and then you get to push beyond it, which is super satisfying. And it takes like every bit of what you've got. It takes every bit of you emotionally, physically, all of this stuff. It's just such a like, to me, such an exciting sport. And thinking about hitting that grade, right? Like that's just like focused, trying to get there, and we'll see. I'll let you know. I'll keep you posted. But there's something within the climbing community that is contagious, is this energy. And there's a phrase that I hear over and over, like climbers, when they're successful, there's this phrase that sort of encapsulates that exuberance, and it's, "Let's go." Have you heard this phrase being used? And I'm like a little too old to be using that phrase. It's more like what the young kids use. And some of you are thinking, I've been using that phrase, "Let's go," for my whole life, right? Like when your kids are late for the bus, you're like, "Let's go." But this is not that. This is like emphasis on the go, and you kind of hold out the O. It's like, "Let's go," right? And you would think it would be used to like kind of pump you up, but it's what's said after you succeed. When you get to the top and you come down and you have this rush of energy, you're like, "Let's go," right? And I think it captures something that's like just such a great part of being human, that we just have this longing to push ourselves, or at least that's part of us in there. This thing that like wants more, this thing that wants to test ourselves, this thing that knows that we're like capable of doing hard things. And I think spiritually speaking, there's a something in there that we like need. When Jesus says like, "Look, this is a narrow road and it's hard to walk." Something in there, we need to like channel this like, "Oh, let's go." Now, the thing is, there's also some danger with "let's go," meaning you kind of need to know where you're going first, right? I was thinking this, I was just at a graduation the other day, and I must have heard that like 100 times, so-and-so graduating summa cum laude, and you would hear from the audience, "Let's go!" Each of these students graduating, and I thought, I wonder if they know where they're going. Probably most of them are thinking, "Back home to figure out what I do next," right? Like, I think oftentimes in life we have zeal, but we have this sort of question of where we're supposed to be going. And we've been studying Mere Christianity, and what I've loved about this book is I feel like Lewis is trying to capture this essence. This is the destination. This is where we're going. And without that understanding, all that zeal, all that exuberance can get channeled into some really misguided directions. I picture like NASA, they're sitting around getting ready to launch some rocket to Mars, and they're going through the checklist, and all of a sudden somebody yells out, "Let's go!" Like, and you can see the astronauts being like, "No, like, let's wait. Like, let's calculate this thing before we fire." And we have this wonderful example in Paul, to me, the guy who has written the bulk of our New Testament, who is somebody that was filled with zeal, filled with passion, somebody that strove with everything in him to try to please God, only to realize that he had been going in the wrong direction. In fact, when he looked at that, all that he had accomplished in all that zeal, he looked at it with tremendous regret. He said, it's refuse. And so instead of like suppressing that zeal, instead what he ended up having to do is rechannel it towards the true goal. And in Philippians 3, he says this, "Brothers, I do not consider that I've made it my own. But one thing I do, forgetting what lies behind and straining toward what lies ahead, I press on toward the goal for the prize of the upward call of God in Christ Jesus." He had taken all that energy, all that like press into it, like let's go. And instead of directing that towards a law or a set of righteousness that he sought to attain for himself, he ended up finding, oh, no. It's a very different goal than that. And it's found in Christ. There's something in Jesus that stands in contrast to where we naturally go in our zeal. Something that almost, for us, it's not where we would naturally be drawn to. We have to be retrained. We have to learn something new. And this is like right at the heart of Christianity, is to say that within all of us, there's a brokenness. So when that zeal is just simply reactivity, chances are we're going to go the wrong way. That Jesus is not just showing us an example, but helping us unlearn this old way, this natural way, is what Lewis would describe it as. And that way is just simply sin. It's the nature of that. And I love this from Mere Christianity. This is how Lewis describes sin. He says, "The natural life in each of us is something self-centered, something that wants to be petted and admired, to take advantage of other lives, to exploit the whole universe. And especially it wants to be left to itself, to keep well away from anything better or stronger or higher than it, anything that might make it feel small. It's afraid of the light and the air of the spiritual world, just as people who have been brought up to be dirty are afraid of a bath. And in a sense, it is quite right. It knows that if the spiritual life gets hold of it, all its self-centeredness and self-will are going to be killed. And it's ready to fight tooth and nail to avoid that." Can you relate? Right? That thing. I love how he says that. That thing that wants to be petted. I don't know about you, but I've got that thing. And it's the worst part of me, right? It's the thing that comes up, and when it does, I'm like, oh, there's that thing. And yet, it can be so shiny at times that to feel that sort of adoration, that self-centeredness, it's sweet. It tastes good, at least at first, but there's an addictiveness to it and something that never quite satisfies us. And this thing is at war with this kind of higher nature. When we think about the greater glory, the thing that we truly desire to go for, this thing fights against it. It tells a twisted version of our story. And so what Jesus is embodying is how to be set free from that. And I like how Lewis says it's a battle, that these two things can't coexist as much as we would like them to. In Romans 7, Paul talks about this within himself, this conflict. And he says it like this. These are great verses. I'm so like encouraged that Paul is willing to admit this to us all. But he says, "I do not understand my own actions. For I do not do what I want to do, but I do the very thing I hate. Now, if I do what I do not want, I agree with the law that it is good. So now it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells in me. For I know that nothing good dwells in me that is in my flesh. For I have the desire to do what is right, but not the ability to carry it out. For I do not do the good I want, but the evil I do not want is what I keep on doing. Now, if I do what I do not want, it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells within me. So I find it to be a law that when I do want to do right, evil lies close at hand. For I delight in the law of God in my inner being, but I see in my members another law, waging war against the law of my mind and making me captive to the law of sin that dwells in my members. Wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from this body of death? And you hear this despair in Paul. He sees the brokenness. In fact, he's going, as I'm getting better, all of a sudden it's like there is evil close at hand. Some of you, as I'm reading that, are going like, yes, this is like last night I'm dealing with this, right? It's this morning on the way to church. It's this thing in me that fights. And so we need to channel that energy, but we need to channel it at the right thing. And that thing within us is this thing that clutches so tightly to our lives. The self-worship, the self-obsession, that's where the battle begins. And I think when Jesus talked to people and held out this invitation, he gave tons of warning about this, but never more specifically to religious people. Isn't that interesting? You would think religion would be the antidote to this, right? What you just need is more rules, more righteousness, just do better things. But the thing is, if we don't get deep down underneath that nature, we just turn religion into another version of the same thing. And this is what Paul saw. This is what Jesus condemned in the Pharisees. When we try to manage our lives based on what is outward, all we do is create, in many ways, a worse problem for ourselves. That we're sitting here with the answer, and then all we're doing is painting, glossing on the outside, and eventually that always goes bad. And I don't know if you pay attention to this stuff, but we live in this world of constant exposure now for things going on in the church. Have you been paying attention to the documentaries that are coming out? You name it. There's one after the next coming out, exposing where the church has focused on the outside to look a certain way, only to have the inside revealed as something unclean. And I don't spend a ton of time watching these things, but they break my heart when I hear about them. Ways where the church professes one thing and then ultimately in the end reveals something really dark and dishonest. And I love how Paul is so transparent about this. He's going like, look, I'm just going to show you this is what's going on inside of me, but this is where the battle is, and this is where the opportunity for real healing is. Takes place. Part of the good news of the gospel is that we can be healed of this. That this is the thing that needs treatment, but it's a dramatic treatment that takes place. It's like chemo, right? That thing in us has to die. It has to go completely. And Paul's saying, I haven't already attained this, but I'm pressing on to that end. To seek to be like Christ is to die to ourselves. And that's what we've signed up for. That's what we're here, like saying, yes, do this work. Realizing at the same time, my tendency is always to go back and pick it back up. I'd like to think that we could somehow come up with a hybrid version of like the old way and the new way. That we can have some righteousness and then some of our fleshly stuff too. Right? That's kind of what appeals. I want to keep some of that pleasure of sin and then mostly righteous. Lewis is going to say it's a little bit like paying our taxes. We want to give God what he's due, but we're really hoping there's something left over for us in the end. And I think that's just sort of a natural tendency on our part. But Jesus is going to say in Matthew 6, he says, no one can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money. But we're like, let's see, right? Let's give that a try. And so often we end up coming up with our own sort of hybrid version of this. But we're reminded again and again, it never goes that way. What your focus is where you're going to end up going. Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. It reminds me of surfing where you always go where you're looking. Do you know this in surfing? Like when you're looking down the line, your eyes are going to turn your shoulders, which are going to turn your hips, which are going to turn your legs, right? So your head ends up being a huge part of your control. And it's why, like, when people get into sort of a crazy situation, like there's somebody in front of them that they're trying to avoid, so often you go straight at them, right? Or if there's a rock down there that all of a sudden you see, you're like, don't look at it. If you look at it, you're going to go right into it there. And I think for us, you see how Jesus is saying, like, that thing that your eyes are set on, that's where you're going to go. So when you're constantly pulling attention back to yourself, constantly worrying about yourself, obsessing over yourself, that's what's going to get fed. That's the part of you that's going to grow. And when we think of the effort and the energy of the Christian walk, it really is about, like, what we choose to set our eyes on. The things we choose to value, that we are going to be shaped and formed in that direction. That Jesus has done all this work on our behalf to bring us to that point. But if we then take and divert our attention or take that focus and pour it on the wrong things, we're going to continue to be shaped in that direction. This thing in us is going to end up having free reign, the self. And you could look at this and think, why doesn't God just leave us be, right? Why would we have these pleasures and have a God that doesn't want us to just, in the end, be happy? Why would he withhold these things? And the truth is, Scripture is saying this again and again, because it doesn't. We think it will, and we chase after it. But all those things end up breaking our hearts. We want to have that little bit of pleasure, but when we get it, it just leaves us unsatisfied and wanting more and more and more, and then leads us to a really dark place. There's a whole book of the Bible written about what happens when we get what we want, and it's called Ecclesiastes. If you want to know what it is like to have every pleasure met, read that book. This is what it's like to have everything that money can buy, every bit of power available, every possession. And the author of the book says this in 2 verse 11, when I surveyed all that my hands had done, what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless and a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. And this to me is the lie that we're constantly being handed, is that our happiness lies just one purchase away, or just one more accolade away, or one more promotion or achievement or next thing. If I can just climb 12A, I'll be happy. And you're like, you won't. You won't. And we've seen that story over and over and over again. That the satisfied life of having every pleasure met turns our life into something that's meaningless and small and boring. Reminds me of that line from that Sheryl Crow song where she says, if it makes you happy, it can't be that bad. If it makes you happy, then why the hell are you so sad? And I think we live in that world, don't we? We live in a world where we're surrounded by what should make us happy and it doesn't. But it doesn't stop us from trying to get more and more and more. And Jesus holds up the answer in defiance of that lie and says the way to true happiness, the way to deep joy and meaning is to let go of that world. To stop chasing after that thing. To drop it completely. The way is this path that Jesus models for us in humility. That is the way. Now that humility, I need to say, is not like a giving up. That we're made for these two realities. We're made for this glorious thing. But that glorious thing is actually not in contrast to humility. It's protected by it. Humility is this way to experience the deep joy. that Jesus is showing us how to be free to really savor that thing. And you know what it's like to not be free, right? It's like you're watching your Instagram, seeing how many likes you've got, right? That's, I hate this about it, but like anytime I would blog and send something out, right? You're like, you get to like check the statistics and see, does anybody care? Does anybody care, right? How many people are reading this? How many people are clicking on this? We live in this world where we're constantly seeking this sort of validation and affirmation. I like how David Brooks said he wrote a book on humility and constantly was checking Amazon to see how the book was doing. So hard, right? This thing in us that just cares so much about what does everybody think? What does everybody think? What is everybody doing? Why am I not invited? How do I curate my life so that it looks a certain way outwardly? And Jesus is saying, don't waste your time. That thing robs you of joy. It creates anxiety. I mean, surprise, surprise, right? As all the statistics are coming out on social media, they're going, this is making people deeply sad. That won't stop us from averting our eyes. We keep going back to that place. And what Christianity holds up is something that just is completely in contrast to that, right? It's saying forget about yourself and live your life generously towards others. Like when we think, let's go, like that's where we're going, like towards generosity. And it does. It stimulates so much goodness in us when we do taste it. We have to practice that though. I've been reading this book of these like little aphorisms from Kevin Kelly. I don't know. I enjoy him, but he said it like this. And I thought it was so simple, but so good. He says, when you give away 10% of your income, you lose 10% of your purchasing power, which is minor compared to the 110% increase in happiness you'll gain. That yes, there's a cost and it seems enormous, right? Like I don't want to let go of this 10% when in fact the joy that you receive from living generously. This is a book of advice that he wished he had learned when he was younger. But this is the invitation. Luke 6:38 says, give and it will be given to you. Good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over will be put into your lap. For with the measure you use it, it will be measured back to you. And that goodness, that blessing, what is he talking about there? Is he talking about money? No, he's not. He's talking about grace. He's talking about forgiveness there. That when you give that to others, when you pour that out, you are filled to overflowing. I like how he's saying it's spilling over. It's running into your lap. That this is the invitation when we think of the good life. Not in some sort of possession or trying to accumulate all of these things, but in this emptying of ourselves. Again, so counterintuitive, but the more you let go of the self, the more of you give over your own pride and self-centeredness, the greater you capacity you have to be able to hold on to that grace, to be filled with it. And I think the deep joy comes by creating that sort of room, living generously, forgiving others, pouring that out, looking for opportunities. This is sort of the secret to life. Is that we're surrounded by opportunity to give grace. Every single one of us, every single day. It should be the thing that we wake up thinking about. Today, in my life, how do I let go of myself and pour grace on others? And can you imagine if the church saw that each day as its mission? That's what we're here to do. That's the thing. Big enough to satisfy that heart of yours and that appetite of yours. That is the story. And the ego is going to get in there and it's going to play havoc with it. But when we choose that thing, what we're doing is choosing to limit the grace that we're able to savor. that self comes in and kills joy. Which is why Scripture tells us it's for freedom that the gospel has come. Freedom from what? Freedom from self. Freedom from pride. In Mark 8, Jesus says, if anyone wants to be my follower, you must put aside your selfish ambition, shoulder your cross, and follow me. If you try to keep your life for yourself, you'll lose it. But if you give up your life for my sake and the sake of the good news, you will find your true life. And how do you benefit if you gain the whole world but lose your own soul in the process? Is anything worth more than your soul? I'm going to read that again. If anyone wants to be my follower, you must put aside your selfish ambition, shoulder your cross, and follow me. If you try to keep your life for yourself, you'll lose it. But if you give up your life for my sake and the sake of the good news, you will find your true life. And how do you benefit if you gain the whole world but lose your own soul in the process? Is anything worth more than your soul? This little secret that we're being shown here, it changes the whole trajectory. That to focus our life on Christ is to follow in his steps. He has done something on our behalf, but we too have to pick up our cross and follow after. And what we find is that is a way down into self-forgetfulness. There's a great story about Lewis that one of his friends tells, where Walter Hooper is writing an introduction to one of his books, and Lewis was becoming popular. Narnia was out and all these people were checking it out. He had done this BBC thing around Mere Christianity that, you know, millions of people had listened to. He was becoming something. And Walter Hooper was said, and I'm paraphrasing, but something like, does that mess with you? I'm like, what do you think of all that fame? And Lewis said, one cannot not think of that enough. You follow? One cannot not think of that enough. And what I like about that phrase to me is he's not just forgetting something. He's deliberately not thinking about something. The part of the energy that goes into the spiritual life is focusing on what matters, but also not focusing on that thing that distracts us. Not focusing on that thing that drags us down. And our eyes are such a vulnerability in this. Our minds, the way we savor and the way we hold on to those things. Which is why Jesus is saying it's not enough to control your outward actions. It's about your heart. It's about the things that you hold on to in your mind. And so the energy of following Christ really is a battle that takes place internally within our hearts, within our thoughts, what we set our minds on, the things that race through our minds. Oh my gosh, I got cut off right here at the top of 3rd Street the other day. Not good things going through Jeff's mind in that moment. Right? And you're like, there's that thing in me that's like, you know what? Nobody does that to me. That thing in me that's like, uh-uh. And in these simple little things come these opportunities. God, give me grace. Let me forgive. He's not asking for forgiveness, but let me forgive. Let me respond in grace. Gosh, I have so far to go still. We all do. And Paul's saying, not that I've attained this, but I press on. Like, let's go. How do I, in my heart and mind, seek to demonstrate that sort of compassion and grace towards others? It requires a self-forgetfulness. It requires a will to not sit there and savor those things. And I don't know about you, but I love to feel like a victim. I love to savor when I've been wronged. I love to feel the moral high ground. Don't you? It feels good to be right. And really what we're being asked to do in humility is just let go of the whole game. By doing that comes the capacity to start doing what we really are here to do. And one of my very favorite quotes from Mere Christianity comes right at the end. And it's where Lewis is describing, this is what this really looks like. It looks sort of invisible. That if you want to know the real Christians, you have to know what to look for. I don't mean that like the special ones, but I mean the ones who are really practicing this thing, like the saints, right? What do those people look like? And it's not going to be the flashy thing. It's not going to be the celebrity thing. It's not, I mean, not saying that those things are wrong per se, just those things, when we go after those things, man, danger. And he models this to me in a way that, to me, is so inviting. He says this. He says, already the new men and women are dotted here and there all over the earth. Some, as I have admitted, are still hardly recognizable, but others can be recognized. Every now and then one meets them. Their very voices and faces are different from ours. Stronger, quieter, happier, more radiant. They begin where most of us leave off. They are, I say, recognizable, but you must know what to look for. They will not be very like the idea of religious people, which you have formed from your general reading. They do not draw attention to themselves. You tend to think that you're being kind to them when they're really being kind to you. They love you more than other men do, but they need you less. We must get over wanting to be needed in some goodish people. That is the hardest temptation to resist. They will usually seem to have a lot of time. You'll wonder where it comes from. When you've recognized one of them, you'll recognize the next one much more easily. And I strongly suspect, but how should I know, that they recognize one another immediately and infallibly across every barrier of color, sex, class, age, and even of creeds. In that way, to become holy is rather like joining a secret society. To put it at the very lowest, it must be great fun. Something about that, I don't know about you, but it captures something in my heart, like the deeper story. A way of living life that's like kind of a conspiracy of kindness. We used to do this thing, and this is entirely my wife's doing, but at Christmas, where we would celebrate the 12 days of Christmas by leaving like a present on the doorstep of somebody that we knew, you know, for each day. It is so fun. I'm sure my kids remember that, kind of putting together these little presents and leaving them there, knowing like the anticipation of the joy that it would bring the next day as somebody came to their doorstep and found this little gift there. It was so wonderful because every family that we did that for would be like, oh my gosh, we didn't know it was you. And this was so fun. You've totally made our Christmas. And I would think, oh, the joy that actually we would experience, I think, would be probably in the end more. And I don't say that as like a pat on our back. I'm saying it as just a simple little illustration. But I think this is what Lewis is saying, is it's not this big complicated thing. That it's as simple as a meal for somebody that you're thinking about. Or even sometimes a note just of remembrance. Noticing other people when they're suffering and coming alongside. Maybe it's just even simply listening to somebody without speaking or constantly giving advice or thinking of that next thing that you want to say. Do you see what he's getting at? There's this capacity inside of him. And Dallas Willard, he puts it this way. He says, you recognize the saints not by the appearance, but by the warmth that emanates from them. And that when we come across one, we recognize that warmth and draw near it like a cold person to a fire. I think this must have been what it was like to know Jesus. That you just felt this warmth, this deep compassion coming from him. Somebody who's not striving to place himself in the center of things, but just able to see whoever is there and then experiencing such joy. You think of Jesus in these gatherings and he's always going to the lowest table in the room and sitting there. But I can only imagine everybody's like, oh, I wish I was sitting there. That there's this gladness that comes in that freedom from self. This is the invitation. Jesus is saying, this is the story big enough. It's worth it to lay these things down. And when we think of mere Christianity, we want to turn this thing into something often so complex when really in the end you see just how simple it is. As Jesus is going to say, what you've done for the least of these, you've done unto me. That to follow Jesus is to care for those in need. And what might appear sacrificial at first turns out to be the greatest gift. The generosity that comes with laying aside that, whatever that is, 10%, is replaced with 110% of gratitude. And this is the invitation to us, I think, as a church, as we come to the end of this series. I'm so glad that we can come to the Lord's table. It's a picture of sacrifice. It's a picture of God's heart being one that compassionately gives. And as we take the communion, we take it with deep gratitude and appreciation. But we also recognize our assignment, don't we? That we come to this table, we are called to give in such a way. We remember what Christ has done so that we in turn can follow. And the beautiful part of all of this is that he hasn't just gone in front of us and is there from the finish line beckoning us to follow. That Jesus accompanies us in this. He comes with us. His Spirit dwells within us. He empowers us to do this. As we take these elements, we realize that we've been given enough, that he is doing a work in us, and that he will be faithful to complete it. I think of Jesus saying to us, come follow me. This was always the invitation. And I don't know about you, but I think, oh, let's go. As a church, let's go. Let's open ourselves to this. Let's lay aside the sin that encumbers us. And let's follow our captain as he leads us forward. Some questions for you before we go to communion. Where do I find my own desires interfering with the direction God's calling me? Are there things that I need to lay aside that are distracting my focus? Those things are encumbrances, right? They weigh us down. Where do I find that resistance in myself? How do I go after that thing and lay that thing to the side? Number two, where do I lack courage to follow? Are there things about God that I don't trust? What am I afraid to give him control over? Because sometimes that path is daunting. Jesus isn't saying, I want you to just lead this simple, self-forgetful life. He often takes us on paths that require so much of our hearts, more and more and more of our hearts, more and more of our trust. How do I continue to give him my heart? And what might it look like to be really free from comparison, jealousy, insecurity? How might this free me up to truly live the life that God has planned for me? And there's a life like that for each one of you, an invitation every single day to take part in. May we as a church have the courage to step into that call and to follow.